Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud. It's only going to get worse, folks. And, you know, by now it gets tiring and it's frustrating. But by now, I want you to know we're actually turning the tables. We're turning the corner. I want to tell you about the very first county constitutional compliance committee. And so we'll dive into that probably more next year and to see what happens, because right now there's all hope for this one committee. Now, I'm saying this right now because usually I go through, you know, it's now or never and the debt is fraud. And the next thing I go through is, you know, calling upon everyone to basically appeal to heaven that, you know, the blessings will be poured out, that our Lord will hear us, our Father will hear us, and that he will give us what we need to restore this government and restore our republic. So with that, I kind of want you to include that those who are involved in applying and creating committees and in government, I would ask that you pray to soften their hearts, open their minds and their ears, that they may be able to receive the message, and actually also ask for the filling them up with the Spirit, or providing them the Spirit to help move them in the ways that they need to be moved. Now, in the beginning of the Constitutional Convention, they were struggling. And it was Benjamin Franklin, who there's a lot of Christians that have bad things to say about the man. And it's easy when we don't have all of the source documents, it's easy to judge others, right? We're quick to judge. But here's the man that actually called upon the body convention to go down the street to the, I think it was the nearest chapel or the nearest church where they could fit into, and open each day in a word of prayer, that they might be able to put aside their differences, and that they may be able to put aside their self-interests, and that they could work together in preserving this union. Now, I'm sure they prayed for other things, you know. As a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, during the Constitutional Convention, there's outbreaks of yellow fever, typhoid, what have you, in Philadelphia. If you study history and you understand those types of things were happening, that particular summer was not a bad infection. It wasn't a bad year for the germs. Or I should say, it wasn't a good year for the germs. It was a good year for actually the people, because they didn't abandon the city. Because several times they actually had to abandon the city because people were getting sick. And it was from the mosquitoes. And they didn't understand what the cause was, because at that point in time, they didn't have the technology and so forth. So nevertheless, there's no doubt in my mind that they probably even prayed that their health and that the city would remain healthy and safe. So please, I mean, prayers are answered. And I have a very strong conviction of this, folks. So if you would, on your own, or create your own prayer group, or what have you, or a group of people that are praying for things specifically, or you can join the Loudoun Liberty. And there's, I believe there's a gentleman from Iowa that dials in, and others. So the point is that we can do this together, or at least we as individuals can appeal by using this very powerful tool, faith and prayer. I mean, I think there's something about faith, you know, just the faith of a mustard seed, something like that, right? Moving mountains, right? So let's not belittle even though we may not understand it. And there's probably a lot of people that may be younger that might be listening to the show that do, if they've never learned or they've never obtained the conviction that that embossed feeling that you know this is right, that nobody could shake, you know, the truth, whatever that is, Christ lives, the Gospels, whatever, right? And so if you don't have those types of unshakable feelings about things in the Gospel, my recommendation, just on a side, because I'm not trying to preach here, my recommendation is to test and try every single one of them, like giving up offerings, tithing, what have you, the giving up of offerings. Do this. Apply the principle in your life and pray that you receive a testimony or a conviction or a changing so that you will no longer not do those things because you know they're right, because the Spirit can manifest those things to you. And I'm here to tell you, folks, that that's how you start developing yourself into a spiritual monster, or you're very strong spiritually. So anyway, please, please make an appeal to touch the hearts and minds of those who are in the positions. I know that there are, you know, specific counties that we're working in, right? There are specific counties that we've already touched, but we have to touch every county. That means a lot of them, all, what, 3,000-4,000 of them, we've got to touch all of them. So, and we need all of them to get on board. And eventually, if enough counties start doing this, and this actually starts, we'll probably get into this as we move down the road. But I don't want to necessarily, you know, perturb anybody, and or especially openly, because there's possibly others that may actually try to focus on, you know, going in and calling these commissioners and other people that, you know, may be in our sights or maybe actually open and working with us. We don't want people calling them and saying, stop what you're doing and that type of stuff. Let the Spirit prevail. Okay. I know that a lot of people like using names and that type of stuff, but I would think that He knows. He knows who they are. He knows, because the Spirit's already engaging. Anyway, let me also say this, because this is my opening lines that I have to really emphasize these. Your campaign begins today. You need to start reaching out to public servants now. You need to kind of put a shot across the bow saying, I'm going to start providing petitions. I want you to understand what these petitions are. These are First Amendment petitions for the redress of grievances. This is something that's not being done. Well, not commonly being done. Bob Schultz of the We the People Foundation has been doing this since the 80s and has been driving these points in, but he's been really driving them more into the court. I believe that the only way to restore our Republican form of government is to drive these issues into your legislators at the county, because they're your legislators, they're under oath, and what we're asking them to do is well within their will. Well, it won't cost them any money, it won't take budget away from them, and it won't take a bunch of time. When you look at the expectations that we put, first, you got to do this, second, third, I mean, there is this grand that this has to stop. There's that. I mean, there's no doubt we put in that this invasion must stop, and that everybody up to Congress needs to be held accountable. However, the point is what we want to do is we want them to start awakening the people. Because this is what happens. This is what happened in Martin Luther, or I should say in Germany, with Martin Luther and the Germanic people. Martin Luther was a young man. I'm just going to really paraphrase this little story. He was a very young man going through the priesthoods. He was committed to serving God. And as he was going through and being naive as a young man, he was looking and reading the scriptures and realizing that, you know, the scriptures say this, but the church is doing this. And he pointed that out to his fellow priesthood holders, because he hadn't received the priesthood yet. He was being trained to receive the priesthood. And as he's, this, like I said, he was a young man, And it didn't take him long to finally realize, wow, you know, as he discovers more and more, he goes, well, I need to do something about this. He was so motivated that he kind of went through and he came up with 95 direct violations or problems. And so what he did was he consolidated all of these problems into one complaint. In other words, each of those problems could have been a petition all by themselves. But what he did was he petitioned the church, including all of the problems. But I'm telling you, folks, that there were 95 petitions. The 95 theses were individual petitions. Okay, so he petitioned the church, and the church ignored him. Now, there's lots of people in America today that try to do something, they get ignored, and they just get frustrated, and they stop. They don't do anything. And they allow a bad experience to dictate their ability to serve. And they remove themselves from service. This is a crime. Because it's not that you were bound and incarcerated and constrained from being able to serve. You chose not to serve. And so I want to be clear here. We need to find ways as citizens who are legally obligated to support the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic, support and defend it against enemies, foreign and domestic. That has been the oath, that has been the implied obligation of every citizen since the beginning. We have a very precious thing here. We don't support, remember, the Constitution's our king. We don't support the president. You know, so those people who get upset because I'm, you know, raining on Trump or any good president because you think they're a good president, they're just men. They're men that the people have chosen. But if the people are choosing kings, then they deserve a tyrant. If we are choosing presidents to serve us in the capacity of their constitutional responsibilities, that's completely different. And this is why our focus, we the citizens, our focus needs to be on that Constitution. We don't have to be wonks, but we at least have to be literate, and we at least have to understand what that is. So Martin Luther, instead of, you know, leaving it at that and letting it go, he was motivated. He didn't let the Catholic Church ignore him, basically shut him up. So he went out, and out of his own personal or however he got the funding, he basically started buying Germanic Bibles and handing them out to the people. That had to have cost him a good pretty penny. And there had been a lot of people that were working with him on this. In other words, he had a small little group, and they were, you know, helping educate people. And his group grew, and it grew and grew and grew. It grew to a point that within 10 years, I'm glossing over a lot of things just to keep this short. But in 10 years, Martin Luther convinced the people of the Germanic states and the monarchs of the Germanic states to abandon the Catholic Church and reform Christianity. 10 years. Now, we're not talking about something that is as difficult and something that is not readily available like the Bible back in those days. It took them a long time to print. We could mass produce and put Bibles in everybody's hands in, you know, within months, easily. The government could actually do it probably within a week or if less. But they would never do that. But they can give you the Constitution. And that in itself will not do anything unless you read it and you actually start looking at it in context to what is being violated. This is why we have a color-coded Constitution for you. Because by putting the color codes to it, we're now highlighting those things that need to be petitioned. We need to demand that these things be complied to. We have another constitution, which is a color-coded enumerations, and we've got to fix it so you can look at it and say, hey, GR, you got to fix this. Fix this. And I will, along with all the other things. But bottom line, start looking at that, because now as you start looking at the enumerations, you start realizing, hold on here. This line right here is a responsibility that Congress has. Can Congress actually change what that responsibility is? No. The only way that line can change is through an amendment. I'll give you responsibility. they have a responsibility to represent the people in the House of Representatives, and that they shall represent no more than 30,000 people. That's what the Constitution says, no more than 30,000. And Madison saw this as a problem. And therefore, what Madison did was Madison submitted in the Bill of Rights an amendment to actually change it as Congress started to grow a little too big, so that it would actually start increasing gradually. Well, they just ignored it, and they never wanted to get that amendment fixed because they wanted to break through the Constitution. They wanted to prove that they don't have to amend anything because we're not holding them accountable. And as they moved forward and they did this, 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 and this, and violated the Constitution by the 1920s, they passed an act, the Reapportionment Act, where they actually said, now we have the power to do whatever we need to do to keep the seats evenly broken up, and we're not adding any more seats. I think they did add a few more seats since then, but that's it. Technically, by the numbers today, we should have about 5,000 representatives. Or maybe 2,500, something like that, for appropriate legislation. Now, in those days, they couldn't fathom how that large of a body could actually function. And actually, this is where, when we start really looking at how they functioned as delegations, that's really what would be happening. Because even though the people of a state have their own representation, and they can, you know, kind of vote for laws and so forth. But when it gets to be so large that you'd break them down into delegations. Now, if it is, and we need to get rid of the popular vote in the House. We really need to get rid of the popular vote because the popular vote has now become one of those things that it only takes a few states and voila, you know, they're doing all sorts of things they shouldn't be doing. But more importantly, we should actually take away their ability to do things they can't do. Then we really don't have to worry too much about the popular vote. Only in making it manageable. But anyway, the point is that we have the opportunity to do this. And I don't think it is going to take 10 years. I think that once this gets started and once you get excited about learning, and about understanding and about becoming a subject matter expert, because we're not talking about quantum physics. We're not talking about really difficult things like feelings. We're talking about clear-cut contract law. It's either in the contract or it's not. That's how simple this is. And so understanding what's in that contract is paramount. Now, moving forward, because that kind of covers your campaign begins today, because you need to start educating people to get them on board. That's how we need to be campaigning. So moving beyond that, there's always been a comment, and I figured now, you know, it's been a little while since Mr. Limbaugh had passed away. But one of the things, because I get told I'm an arrogant person by people that don't like what I'm saying. And I think that maybe there might be a hint that they perceive that, or there might be a hint that I can be. And when it comes to being right, I think I can be arrogant. But when I think about how popular arrogance makes somebody, Rush Limbaugh is the epitome of this. Didn't he, correct me if I'm wrong, folks, didn't he actually say talent on loan by God? That he had the talent on loan by God to speak to us. In other words, it almost elevated him to be like a prophet. Is that not arrogant? I'm just asking because, you know, I want to place context to arrogance. I think humility is a trait and a characteristic that is absolutely needed. You know, it's easy to judge others. It's easy to attack people. It is difficult to try to appeal to people to get them to recognize what we need to do. And it takes sometimes humility to do that. And maybe I can be humble. I hope I am. I hope I'm, you know, I hope I can at least continue to help push this ball down the road. Who knows? But I do know we all have our time, and Rush's time is beyond him. And so Now we actually have all the conservative entertainers who are fighting for that big pie that Rush Limbaugh created. Because even though he couldn't speak 24/7, it opened up the door because people just had to have conservative talk 24/7. So what that meant was these radio stations actually had the opportunity to make more money with different hosts. And so it was great, right? I mean, now they're making money. This is good. It's the goose that lays the golden egg. Reality is this, folks. There is no one that is a conservative entertainer that is, as far as I'm concerned, I'd love to be proven wrong. And as a matter of fact, I would bet my life on this, that there's not one person that's willing to actually kill the goose that lays their golden egg. It is antithetical to how people think, how people operate. People are withums, what's in it for me? People are very self-serving, and, you know, we haven't become a more righteous people. We've only become a more carnal and a more self-serving and indulging people. And this is because we've allowed our mores to be debased. And therefore, as we kind of look, you know, of what the heck's going on, and I remember telling a story about one of my daughters that had too much money coming back from the store. She felt bad. So I told that story. And the same daughter really impressed upon me, you know, how as parents, we really have to be very careful with what we say and do, because they are watching. And they are watching. And so when you make a mistake, you know, even though the Bible tells us as children to honor and obey our parents, there is no scripture out there. I mean, Locke covered this in his two treatises of government. There is no biblical scripture that tells the parents to honor and obey the children. This is a duty that the children must have. The children must humble themselves and obey and honor their parents. And so as we kind of look at this, you know, at this process of educating and engaging our children, you know, I realized that I never sat down and really taught and spoke politics, because I think that the subject matter for my daughter and other children and you know, it was just beyond them. And even though she was still young, I want to say she was probably 10 or 11. When I was listening, because I wasn't talking and I wasn't doing anything else, and she had some friends over, and I want to say about 12, maybe 14, something like that. And I was listening to her, and they were talking about politics, and her friends had very liberal perspective, and she was fighting left and right and repeating things I said. And I'm going, wow. I mean, I'm not telling her to say those things and do those things, but she's doing this on her own. Folks, if we don't have children that are standing up and arguing and winning arguments because they can actually cite, you know, information and refute bad information through citations, if we're not preparing our children to be able to withstand the onslaught of these lies and deceit from the progressive world, then how can we survive? This is why this goes down this path in my book, as I talked about the historical narrative of liberty. It was very well understood a long, long time ago. Society, way back and even beyond ancient Rome, or actually ancient Greece, prior to ancient Rome, that, well, I'm going into a break. So I'll stop here, and I will dive into what I had to say regarding children, because this actually helps people, I think, place context to why we have such an out-of-control society. That being said, we've got a promo coming up, and so I will go ahead and stop right here, and we'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so ancient Greece and even beyond, I'm sure even ancient Egypt, because it was a very statist government. As we look historically, and as a matter of fact, when we even look at the Bible and what we were taught there, the importance of influencing children properly is paramount if we're going to have a good society. The home is the nucleus of every society. And if the majority of the homes turn its back on God, then society will turn its back on God. Children will do. And as a matter of fact, even though, let's just say you have, you know, a couple that actually, you know, kind of fell in love or infatuated or what have you, even though they were not necessarily heterosexual orientation, they may have been, you know, wandering or what have you. And and let's just say that as we kind of watched these, you know, this couple have children and so forth, whatever they expose to those children can actually, because I want to work this two ways. If they actually expose to the children things of righteousness and of good, then there's a great likelihood, and they were the example of that, then the outcome would be awesome. Now, on the converse side, there's all sorts of ways they can go, right? So the parent, you know, one of the parents, they get divorced, and one of the parents becomes a deadbeat, you know, parent. Whoever the breadwinner is, let's say a deadbeat mom, because we always say deadbeat dad. So just to be fair. So a deadbeat mom, you know, would be castigated by the custodial parent. And, you know, the kids would be basically are used as a weapon to hurt the other spouse. We do those things, right? When we get divorced, or maybe when we stay together, we make mistakes and we talk about, let's say I did drugs or what have you. And whatever you tell your children, and you're being honest, and you're telling them at a very young age when they can't, because you just want to be honest, right? And maybe you're not really trying to teach them the morals and so forth, but you want to at least be honest. And you give them information about you and other things that are way too early in their life to actually process that. What ends up happening is that it clings in their head, and as they start moving forward, when they get to that age where they're confronted with the opportunity of drugs, well, why not? My parents did. Even though you say don't do it, they will. I mean, it takes a very special child not to, because they're so impressionable. So this goes to the story I was about to say during the break, or before the break, that in my book, I call out, and actually to build up to this, I pointed out that in the Weisenhop's Illuminati Charter, he talks about how important it is there to work and condition the children by using tolerance and those types of things to get them to gradually and incrementally move away from their world of, you know, values, morals, and Christ and religion towards godlessness and immorality and open to, you know, all sorts of debased debauchery. And so as we kind of looked, there was this teacher that was really upset in Florida because they were actually starting to win the argument that there were certain things that they wanted the parents to teach in the home. And this teacher says, are you kidding me? The children are way too impressionable. Those types of things should not be taught in the home. This was back in the 90s, folks. This is how emboldened the education system had already been by these ideologues. The 90s. That child that was in, I think it was in second grade, and I cited, it's actually in my book cited, but and I can pull it up if you're interested. Say, hey, I'd like to know the citation. But as I look at this, I go, that child has already graduated and has got hopefully has gone to school to where, or they've gotten a skill, something where they're a productive member as an adult, hopefully. But the odds are worse and worse for our children to becoming productive members of society. They're going to be productive shills for corporations, they'll be productive shills for government and what have you, but they won't be a productive member of society. I can almost guarantee that. And that's a sad prediction. It's an indictment of our society today. So as I lay all this out in front of you, I kind of want to, because I'm supposed to go into this presidential support or supporting President Trump and what he could be doing and what he should be doing. But what I want to do is I kind of want to mention that today and on Monday, I'm planning on kind of going through a year review of what we've covered this year. What you've missed, those of you who have just started tuning in, because our audience has grown a lot lately. And I think that's because maybe, I'm just guessing, that maybe you're getting really tired of conservative entertainers. You're not learning anything that helps you, you know, connect the dots and really understand what precisely we need to be doing. This is why we just covered the resolutions of Kentucky and Virginia, and then the Kentucky final resolutions where Kentucky chose not to nullify and that they were calling for resistance. I mean, they were going to continually call for resistance, that they needed the states to bond together and work together in getting the federal government into compliance to these, you know, and get rid of those laws, that they wouldn't nullify them. They needed to get the government to nullify them because that is the appropriate authority. So as we kind of look at all of this and what Madison asserted with interposition and how Madison really spelled this out, I can't give you any greater secret to engaging your government for the best. In other words, in getting our government back into the course that the Constitution created. Or I could even say that the divine hand of providence had created for not just us, but for the world. Even though the framers didn't see these types of things, it is clear to me that this Constitution was made for all humanity and all nations who embraced individual liberty and individual sovereignty. Those theocracies, those governments, those statist governments, those theocracies that do not want individual liberty, they want to subjugate you. You've got to be a part of their theocracy. That is not how our Father in Heaven wants us to be as citizens. I believe that we become a theocracy and will willingly become a theocracy when Christ comes and actually, you know, reigns. That's when we become the theocracy. We should actually be doing everything to put off theocracies. It's one thing to have religion involved in our lives and, you know, providing compassion service, because that's what they should be doing, not government. But that's, these are all nuances and other stories. The point is this. What I want to do is give you a year in review of these topics that we cover. And so that way, I think you'll look forward to how things are going to come forward, because we go through the ratification debates. Our focus for the year, the largest body of podcasts that we go through, are the ratification debates. Why? Because the ratification debates are the framers, the men that were actually involved in framing that Constitution at the Constitutional Convention and then helping everybody understand it. And it's that process of helping everybody understand it in these state debates where you truly learn the Constitution and how it works within the state and so forth. Because they're telling you, the framers themselves are actually telling you what these lines mean, because believe it or not, they actually go through the Constitution line by line. Okay, so this is why it is the most important book, the most important, actually it's not a book, it's books, but the most important documents. This is the national treasure. And, you know, it's so downplayed. As a matter of fact, we're going to, before we do this, before we get into the ratification debates, I'm going to repeat our special analysis of the Federalist Papers and why the Federalist Papers were chosen by the law people, by the folks of law, to claim that that is their authority of the Constitution, and why it's not, and nor should it be. And we actually have to look at the Federalist Papers as maybe insightful, but they're very dangerous. And that's because of one of the men who were involved, who was involved in writing that. It was Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton has proven to me that everything he said is in question. When you look at what he said prior to the Constitution being ratified, I think he was being honest, because he was really trying to get people to actually ratify the Constitution based on these principles. But as soon as the Constitution was ratified, this man went wild in basically undermining and subverting and doing things that would actually violate the Constitution. So there's some things that I would love to share. I just really love to share, but it's just way too personal. But that all being said, I do need to dive into the what Trump needs to do regarding, reconstructing our national, reconstituting our national security system. That's actually the title. So we're reconstituting our national security system. And I've covered quite a bit already on this. But what still needs to be said is I actually need to read through what the enumeration in the Constitution actually says. What is the federal government's responsibility, and how do they do this? Now, when we look at, this is the clause, this is in Article 1, Section 8, and I think it's subsection 15. Congress shall have the power to provide for organizing, this is about the militia, for organizing the militia. I'm going to actually inject some words here. Organizing the militia, arming the militia, and disciplining the militia. And it actually says disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them, the militia, as may be employed in the service of the United States. In other words, when they're called up, Congress shall have the power to call them up. So they basically create this governing, disciplining, what they need to be able to do when they're called up. They need to know what they need to do and how to do it when they're called up. And so when they're in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of the training. In other words, who trains them? Well, the state is supposed to train them. They have the authority of training, but that doesn't mean that they're funding that. Because right here at the very beginning, this is what they're funding. They're providing for organizing, you know, how to create the structure to serve, arming and disciplining. What is the disciplining? That's training. Training and disciplining is absolutely, because let me go further. It actually says this, and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. So in other words, Congress is going to prescribe exactly what has to be done. And they have, if they're providing for the disciplining, that means that they're funding it. Now, the one thing, the only thing the federal government should be doing regarding education is this. This is actually an act that they have a responsibility to educate us regarding these topics. The training, or the organizing of the militia, the arming of the militia, and the training, the disciplining of how to function, how to work, how to pull a trigger, you know, the tactics, techniques, procedures in functioning within a militia. Now, who needs to have this training? Well, technically, when you think about it, who is, and you know, what is the youngest age to serve? Because that person who has to serve at that point in time, let's say it's 30 years old. Well, then the onus is on the government, the federal government, to pay for and make sure that every 30-year-old in every state is ready to actually serve in the militia. This is, the Constitution demands this stuff. Okay, it's the supreme law of the land. So then they need to actually make sure that every young man and woman, because what is the standard today? The standard as of yet, or as of now, I should say, is Congress has established both men and women to serve in combat. And I believe right now, only men sign up for selective service. In other words, they're the ones that have to serve. But I believe if we really look at the application, that means that anybody and all can actually serve. So everybody must be trained. And I believe that we may go down that path of where Congress will actually say women have to sign up for the draft. It can't be racist. I mean, it is absolutely not racist, sexist. It cannot be sexist, right? At least as they say, the both can serve. When you have to compel one, you should be able and must compel the other. The problem is that this goes in line with the states failing to actually adopt this, because most states' constitutions only point to male members, or men are the only ones that serve in the militia. Sorry, if your constitution states that, then it's not in line with the supreme law of what Congress has actually determined of how the people of the states are to serve as both men and women. So anyway, as we drive into this, to provide for the organizing, this is regarding the federal employment, and the states must actually have the structure and how to plug in. Now, when you really look at it, you may have batteries. You may have, you know, one state will not have all of the artillery. In other words, every state has to have an artillery attachment because let's say it's their turn to step in. Well, then they have to be able to bring to the table. Now, there may be some states just due to population that won't be able to do all of that, but they'll still need to be able to do something of that. Why? Because the state should have the ability to do everything it needs to do in repelling an invasion and or suppressing an insurrection. In other words, if the people are starting to revolt, they need to have the weaponry, they need to have the training of how to effectively do that without causing a lot of harm, without killing everybody, right? We want to be able to fight wars where we dominate and we don't necessarily destroy everything and everyone. I mean, you know, I know the Lord may do that when he gets upset with us, but he's been putting up with a lot. He's putting up with a lot, and we know the destruction's coming. But anyway, all that being said, there is this responsibility that the states need to have this organization and all the different structures somehow, one way or the other. Now, we're not talking about naval, right? We are not talking about naval service. Naval service and Marine Corps service is completely different. That is a standing obligation that the federal government has to keep the Navy. They have to maintain it, and they have to maintain the Marine Corps. They don't have to, and as a matter of fact, they shouldn't be employed at this point because we're not going to war. They're not going to war. And as a matter of fact, if we're not fighting war on American soil, then the Army shouldn't even be in it should only be functioning as a militia within the states. Okay? It's the way we don't understand really has caused or given them so much latitude to make it up as they go along, which is why, I mean, we have an awesome military structure and so forth to do all sorts of evil in the world. Even though we've always been the good guys, because we've self-constrained ourselves. Boy, had we been the bad guys like Russia or China, man, the world would be just reeling today. As a matter of fact, it'd probably be, you know, nothing but conquest. But we didn't do this for conquest. And what ended up happening as we started migrating or basically becoming corrupt, we became the leader in trying to bring all nations into the, we, We're the ones that are subsidizing global communism. I've been saying this for years. And we've been basically co-opted by Britain and all sorts of other entities to actually support, and we are driving. This is why the federal government became the Antichrist Church as well. Even though there were all sorts of other states and nations that, you know, opposed Christianity to some degree, they weren't attacking it to the degree that we are today. Now, there may be some, I mean, like Hitler and so forth, but the point is it's truly an organization that they have created, an Antichrist Church, without actually appointing a pope or a leader, because the leader sits in the dark. We're not to know Satan's behind all of this. So anyway, they're also to provide for arming. In other words, every person prior to having come of age by 17, so every person needs to go get their first firearm or two, a long gun, a long barrel, and a, you know, a holstered barrel, or, you know, a pistol, I should say. And so the long barrel being a, not necessarily a sniper, but one that actually can project force a little bit farther off, like in, you know, an AR, or what have you, those types of guns. Now, if we actually did this right, this would really alleviate, I think, a lot of the firearms. Other than the niche market for connoisseurs and competitors and those types of things, we would really come down to, you know, the best, the most effective, and the most affordable. Because once you actually nail it down to this is what we're going to do, then all of a sudden it becomes very cheap to make. So as long as you've got the choices of the different types of handguns and or long rifles, then, you know, there's going to be that, oh, well, let's, I like this one better. But the federal government is the one that has to make the choice. Unfortunately, that is in the Constitution. They're the ones that make those choices for arming and organizing. They're the ones that create the standards. So every child by probably 15 or 14 should be receiving their firearm. And they're going to be taught how to clean it. They're going to be taught safety before they ever fire a round. They're going to be, you know, in their heads, they're going to understand what these weapons will do and can do. And they're going to have a respect, because we can teach those things that. The problem is, and the reason why we're going to have a real problem with this, is because we have a nation that is absolutely preparing sociopaths. This is why there is such a rise of sociopaths, because we're not teaching them morals either. So this is where the school actually goes, you know, and I think the state schools need to actually address this. They need to say, we need to bring back prayer and Bible. We need to actually start bringing in morals in the school. Not ethics, morals. Right and wrong. Anyway, so the federal government provides for arming. They're going to actually pay for you to have a gun. And if it gets broken or what have you, then they need to replace it, unless you broke it. Or if it gets worn out because of your years of service, and because you got to go to the rifle range every year, you got to go to the handgun range or the pistol range. Technically, it's not just that. There's this other types of training, like, you know, close quarter combat scenarios and that type of training as well. As well as, now we get into the training, provide for training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. So in other words, Congress is going to pay and tell what you actually have to train in each state, and then they're going to be trained. You know, everybody is going to be trained on the handguns and what have you, but they're also going to get training, because this is how it is in the Marine Corps. Every year you have to go and qualify. You have to make sure that you're a marksman, at least at a minimum, or an expert, or sharpshooter, what have you. Sharpshooter would be in the middle. But you qualify for your weapons, your own personal weapons, and then you have to actually have other training to be able to function in working and repairing radar systems, repairing, you know, communications, cooking. There's a variety of what we call military occupational specialties that everybody throughout each state, you need to have a balance to make sure a state can function. So the state actually really needs to delineate how they can support this structure to make sure that they have in their own accord, in their own hands, a functioning militia that can serve the governor when necessary, as well as serve the sheriff or the executive of the county when necessary. Because technically, the sheriff is just the top cop, right? He's just the top enforcer. The actual commander in chief should be the executive of your county. Most counties don't have executives because we fail to actually provide the proper structure of government, which is why we have this lopsided jurisdiction, or I should say this judiciary form of government, because the court's everywhere. And the court has actually jumped on top of our representatives, taking away our representative government, and basically denied us of our executive. This is all by their doing. This is all because Hamilton made the plan and built this all in into the Federalist Papers and so forth, that this would be the outcome. So when we start looking for the training and the militias, discipline and all of this, this is something that really needs to be quartered and apportioned. As a matter of fact, when we really think about it, every person that's going to public school and or any school needs to have this training, and that the state should get the funding from the federal government to ensure every private and public school is teaching their children before they reach 17 to be able to function within a militia, just the functioning firearms. In other words, you're at least a ground pounder grunt. Now, beyond that, as 17, when you become, I guess, more capable of learning other things, such as either law enforcement, like military police, or like I said, radar, what have you, then that becomes a part of the higher education that needs to be done in every state school. In other words, a state college and or a state university. Because we want to actually have very smart people serving us. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that we need to do today, this is really going to piss people off, we need to get rid of the separation, or I should say the two rank structures. We should only have enlisted. And that's because the enlisted do not need people educated to manage them. As a matter of fact, we should be finding that everybody, if we're doing this right, everybody in the service will actually have ample education, that they don't need to have somebody sign for them, that they're not going to mark X on the paper. If you do not have the training, then you have to go through the training before you can actually get into the militia, before you get your gun, before all of these things. I mean, when you get your gun is when you have to do all of this stuff. And if you don't finish the training, then you lose your gun and it gets sent to somebody else. If you're a conscientious objector, you lose your gun. It gets sent to somebody else. But everybody else has to have one. Everybody else has to have the training. They have to have, I'll just call it at what it is. It is, they call it CE. It's current education. You need to maintain a minimum of, you know, yearly education to maintain your capabilities of serving. You don't become stagnant. Anyway, hopefully all this makes sense. We'll be back on Monday. We'll go through a year in review along with this militia stuff. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flow chart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.